And welcome to Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from NAMI Philadelphia, we have its Education and Outreach Manager, Becca Lane. Becca, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, I can't wait to talk about, one, a great victory, and two, how you are doing, or I should say how we are doing following the reopening of the world here.
Right.
Yeah, we have an ambitious half hour ahead of us.
Yes.
Well, let's get started first, though, before I ask anything. Can you give us a rundown, the mission and who and what NAMI is?
Sure. So NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We're the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization. And our mission is to build better lives for the millions of Americans who are impacted by mental illness, whether that is individuals who are living with mental illness themselves, or family members, loved ones, caretakers, or just people who are advocates. So, and we do that in a few different ways. We do that through advocacy, resources. We provide a lot of resources for the community, support. We have a whole variety of support groups for people living with mental illness, family members, some that are even more specific, like for the queer community, for people who identify as male, people who identify as female, for just individuals who live with depression. So we have a whole variety of support groups. And then we also provide education, and we have, and we'll talk a little bit about our educational programming, but we do offer educational programs for youth, for family members, for peers, and we have a few different programs that we offer.
And this does affect a heck of a lot of us. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been doing NAMI a long time. And one in five of us will experience some kind of a variation in our mental health over the course of our lifetime. That's one in five.
Yes, yes. And that goes up for young people. And the thing for young people in particular is that it takes about 8 to 10 years for them to seek treatment. So from the onset of symptoms. And so that's why what we do is so important, because there's not a lot of education surrounding mental health. So people can go a really long time without getting, you know, if we're talking about one in five, like I always say I do presentations, you know, especially to our young people, but I do presentations talking about mental health and warning signs, suicide prevention. And one of the things I say is like one in five, right? Like it might not be affecting you right now, but it's one in five over the course of their lifetime. So even if it's not you, you have five friends or family members, you know, something might be going on with them, or at some point that you want. So you want to be educated and understand what mental illness looks like, what mental health conditions look like. So that's why it's really important.
Well, let's start off with, I alluded to congratulations, because I know NAMI, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, all these groups, you've been working so hard and you finally got it accomplished, 988.
And yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about 988 and what that's going to do? And of course, we've been talking about it again for years here, but now it's finally operational.
Yes. And it's really exciting because, like you said, we've been talking about it for years. So a big issue that had been occurring was when there was a mental health crisis, people would call 911, right? And you know, there's been a lot of backlash with how police respond. We don't need to go into that. But police are there to, you know, respond to crimes, and a mental health crisis is not a crime. So while there is trainings like crisis intervention training for police, that's not their job. So we really thought it was important for there to be a line that was as easy to remember as 911. So 988. Where people could call when there was a mental health crisis, and then there would be a mental health response. Somebody who was trained in how to handle a mental health crisis. And sometimes that would just be somebody talking to somebody on a phone. So the people who answer 988 is it'll be the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which has been in existence for a long time. But they had a whole long 1-800-273-TALK number. And so it's still that, like, that number will, or that organization will answer the phone, but they will connect you to your local crisis response team. So, and you know, there's, this just rolled out. So there's going to be still some specifics that are getting worked out depending on where you're located. But we have a crisis, a mobile crisis team in Philadelphia that will respond. The person that answers the phone will assess the situation and see whether a mobile crisis team is necessary, whether they need to talk to whoever's there and have them take the person to, a hospital or a crisis center. So it's somebody that is trained, like, not just, you know, for maybe this might happen at some point, but this is what they do. So they know how to respond.
You might still have 911 response depending on what the dispatcher decides. But there again, it's, you're having somebody answering the phone who will understand and be trained to do this. A 911, you didn't know who would be picking up the phone, and
Right. They
would have to send what help was available. And that obviously wasn't always always working, but and I know that this had been approved years and years ago, but getting the money for it state by state, cobbling together the answering system, and it's taken this long, and it is now finally launching, and that's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't just so easy as let's change the, you know, like, let's go like to the system and just you direct the number to this number instead. It was, you know, there was a lot that was involved in, you know, figuring out the system of like who was going to be answering, what teams were going to be responding. You know, there's a couple of cities, and I think Philadelphia is one where they are piloting these CERT teams, which are crisis emergency response teams, where there might be a police officer, but also mostly social worker who will respond. And that can go through 911 as well. But, you know, this also helps to open up the police to be able to respond to situations where a crime is being committed and they're special skills can be
it's going to be an informed responder is the important mm-hmm. part here. It's going exactly. to be somebody who knows that they are going to a mental health crisis.
Exactly. Yeah. So and you know, I had to call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline recently because this is the other thing, is that you can call that number even if you're not the one in crisis. And I am trained in this field, and But I had a situation arise with a young person who I had just met through some support groups and stuff that were online, and she was in crisis, and I was on the phone with her, but I didn't know where she was located. So I called the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. I kept her on the line, and I called the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and I just asked questions, and I was like, I don't know what to do, like what to say, how to, and they literally told me what to say in the text message I sent her. And then I had her conference in, and they talked to her, tried to, like, you know, figure out where she was located. And so you don't need to be in a situation where somebody is standing, you know, an immediate risk of, you know, possible suicide. It can be any sort of situation that is really tough, to put it mildly.
Well, because intervention and conversation is key in all of these situations. And of course, if you're not informed, I'm not trained, but that was always the blessing of the National Suicide Prevention Line, and now 988, and their you know, the text line. All of these things are still in operation. The text line, 741-741. You didn't have to be in a crisis, and it didn't have to be you. You could call or text and say, I'm going to start a conversation. Oh, brother, help me before I open my mouth. And they were there to give anyone counsel. And now we've got one more wonderful piece that I think anybody can remember, 988.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the hope, is that it's something that can be ex accessed by more people.
Oh, let's move on. We had 2 years of being isolated, and then we have now this reemerging. And are we better or worse for wear out of that? Are numbers going up, or are we stable where we were before COVID came along?
So I do know that numbers are definitely going up. Before COVID, we had actually seen suicide rates going down finally after over 20 years of them consistently going up. We had finally seen them in 2019 going down, and then the pandemic began. And at first, it just leveled out. It didn't go up or down, which was great. But it has started to rise again. I do know that. I don't have specific numbers, so that is something that anyone can Google. I know for a long time they didn't have exact numbers because it was hard. They were relying on self-reporting, and people weren't gathering in groups where they could be doing studies or anything. But also, they do get information through hospitals, and but for a long time during the pandemic, people weren't going to the hospital, and that was an issue because they were, one, scared of COVID, and there weren't beds available. And that was a real issue because a lot of the nursing staff and just hospital staff were reallocated to fighting the COVID. So there wasn't a lot of resources for individuals. And I think that now, people are coming out of the pandemic, and the isolation was definitely real during the pandemic, but people got comfortable in that isolation as well. So I believe that from the young people that I've talked to, what has been really hard for them going back to school in person, and that's really only started to begin, because last year they were able to make the choice of whether they wanted to be in person or not, and now they are all back in person. So they've talked about how they were, especially the younger students, but even high school students, they were in isolation during really important years for their social development. So that those social skills that they have been developing, because they were out of practice, right? So when they came back and they were in these situations where there was tons of people around, it was overwhelming. So one young person that I talked to said that she was thankful for extroverts because they were the ones that were able to kind of make everybody start engaging, so that it wasn't, there weren't just people feeling awkward. They were the ones that were kind of making the social situation feel more regular.
Well, let's talk about kids. You just introduced the topic again. Is there a difference between mental illness in young people and in adults? Do they have the same issues that we have?
There are definitely differences. Like, for instance, certain mental illnesses that have more psychotic features don't really start to present until early to later or early adulthood to, later adulthood. So, we don't see as many psychotic diagnoses, but that's not absolute. There are definitely some people who experience psychotic symptoms in when they're younger. We also don't really see a lot of personality disorder diagnoses. Those are harder for young people to get diagnosed with just because they are developing their who they are. As they get older, we might see diagnoses such as oppositional defiance disorder when they're younger. That might be an indicator of a personality disorder, but when you're not going to get a diagnosis of something like that as a child. But the mood disorders can get tricky because when we think of teens, what do we think of? We think of moody teenagers, right? But what's important to remember is that there's a very different thing between a feeling and an emotion and a symptom. So it's all based on the severity, and you know, everything's on a spectrum. So someone might feel sad when something bad has happened, you know, in a response to a negative event in their life, but when they're feeling sad for no reason whatsoever, and it's gotten to a point where they're not leaving the house or their bedroom, and don't want to talk to their friends anymore, they're losing interest in things that they had previously been interested in. And that also is difficult because, like, they're figuring out who they are, right? So they're developing new interests and what their parents are telling them they're interested in, what they're actually interested in. But it's more of like just not being able to experience joy. So those are some of the symptoms that are, you know, necessary to look at. There's also an overwhelming instance of anxiety in young people today that has never been seen before. And when I talk to some older people, especially generationally older, a lot of times people are like, oh, these kids today, they don't, you know, they're so ungrateful, or, you know, what do they have to be anxious about? And there's a lot to be anxious about. The world is changing very rapidly. And the use of, you know, everybody's like, oh, social media. Well, it's true. The use of social media can produce a lot of anxiety. Pressure is so much bigger than it was for previous generations in terms of needing to be the best, because all you see online is the best, right? It's at people at their best, their highlight reel, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So that's been an overwhelming situation that's been occurring for a lot of young people. And so that's, like I talked about, depression and anxiety, and those are really high risk factors for suicide.
You had mentioned that kids, it takes them a lot longer to be diagnosed with a mental illness, and it can present, or it does present, as early as what, 14 is. I have 14 in my head right here. Is 14 a magic number when talking about mental illness?
Well, it's that 50% of cases of mental illness or mental health conditions present by the age of 14. So by 14, so they present, like, they can present at any age. We had a speaker actually at our walk who, and I do want to mention our walk. Can I just mention that?
Yes, fast? You can mention your walk.
So I do. So one of the things that's so special about NAMI is that everything that we offer in terms of programming, resources, is completely free of charge to participants. Nobody has to pay to enroll in any of our educational programs. Schools don't have to pay to have us come in and do our educational programs. People don't have to pay to come to our support groups. So, but the thing is, it's not free of cost to us. So that's why we need to fundraise. So the weekend of September 25th, we had our third annual NAMI Walks Philly. And this was our third annual, but if you think about it, it's 2022. So our first two were 2020 and 2021. So our first was completely virtual, and our second was a hybrid, but it was a small, like, it was at Friends Hospital. So it was a cap at 150 people. So this year it was fully in person. It was at the Navy Yard. It was incredible. It was so wonderful to see all these people who, like, we've only met virtually for a lot of them, and to see all the support that we got. And I do just want to say, even though the walk is passed, we are still accepting donations up to 30 days if you want to receive or to be eligible for an award, and then up to 60 days just to donate and support us so that we're able to continue doing all the incredible programming that we offer.
Well, at the end of every show, I always do point out that donations are always appreciated, and you can find a way to do that online, safe and secure. You can donate to NAMI at any time, whether you make it in time for the walk or not. You can always donate at namiphilly.org. But now let's get back to our conversation. And so at the walk, you had a speaker?
a speaker. Yes, we had a speaker who talked about a sibling who had been diagnosed with mental illness at 5 years old.
Ooh.
She mentioned a few different mental illnesses, and I'm not sure that all of them were diagnosed at five because one of them was bipolar disorder, and I've not really ever heard of a bipolar diagnosis being given at that age. I don't know if the symptoms that are necessary for a bipolar diagnosis would be evident by that age, but there was ADHD and some depressive episodes, and I mean, it's suicide is always hard, but when you see young people who have not experienced any life, real life yet, at a point where they're feeling suicidal or even are dying by suicide, it's incredibly horrifying. So there was a 5-year-old at one of the schools in Philadelphia here who a few years ago took his own life. And so, you know, it's not impossible and it's not unheard of. There are a lot of young under, you know, in lower school, elementary school age that are having suicidal ideation, depressive episodes. So it's never too young to have this conversation.
Who should that conversation be with? And do kids speak better with their own peers? Or, I mean, and do they speak of this differently than adults do? And a lot of adults don't talk about it at all, which has always been one of the ongoing conversations about this, that we don't talk about mental health amongst ourselves. It's never a dining room conversation.
Right. Well, I think that one of the things that is so incredible about this generation is I believe they're Gen Alpha. I think Gen X is now, you know, older. I think they're Gen Alpha is what I have heard recently. They are so much more in touch with feelings and emotions and accepting, you know, like a lot of people talk about like just even like gender fluidity and sexual fluidity, but also in terms of talking about how they're feeling and bullying and all of that. So I find that really encouraging. But still, I know a lot of young people, and I'm talking about like high school students or the students that I've worked with the most, are definitely reticent to talk with their parents and definitely. And a lot of them are feeling like they can't talk to their school counselors, which is really sad because there's not a lot of school counselors. And that's an issue as well that does, I think, get in the way of young people dealing with their mental health. But they don't trust school counselors because they feel like they'll get in trouble if they tell their school counselor something that might be concerning. And you know, the school counselors are required to report, you know, they're minors. So school counselors are required to report, especially if a child is in danger. So that can be hard. So I think well, I know that peers are definitely who they will be confiding in more than anyone else.
So that's why your in-school programming is so vital.
Absolutely. So I have to tell you that we started this program called Ending the Silence in 2017, and it's a NAMI signature program, but we started it here in Philadelphia in 2017, and we have reached over 16,000 students in the Philadelphia area. And that's just in Philadelphia. Like there are affiliates in Montgomery County and Delaware County and Berks County. So that's just in Philadelphia. And it's been so rewarding. I've had students tell me that because we'll go back to schools year after year. And I've had students tell me like, because of our presentation, they called the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, or they've texted 741-741, or they opened up to their friend. And, you know, I'll cry because that's just who I am. I'm emotional. It's been really, really rewarding to see that the programming that we offer in schools has really had a positive impact.
Well, and it is free to schools, and I'm going to guess
Exactly.
that any youth group can also request this. How do schools or groups reach out and get this into their programming?
So they can go to our website, namifilly.org and fill out a form, a request form, or they can email me specifically, BeccaLane@namifilly.org. But we do offer a whole variety of programs. So Ending the Silence is like, I started it. I've been doing it since we started it, and it's really changed my life. But we also offer In Our Own Voice, which is more of, because the thing about Ending the Silence that's so impactful is that it's not just, I mean, we'll talk about the warning signs and symptoms of mental illness and suicide prevention and fighting and, you know, stigma reduction and what to do. But we have a young person also share their own story of their mental health journey. So kids get a chance to ask questions, interact with a person who has that lived experience, which is so powerful. So we also offer In Our Own Voice, which is really just the speakers, the storytellers. And then we also are now offering programming for older people. We offer a presentation called Stigma Free Corporations or Companies, where we can go into different companies and do presentations on how to create a stigma free workplace. And then also provides warning signs and, you know, what to do when your colleague is suffering or you are. And then we also have a NAMI 101 presentation where we can go anywhere and talk about what NAMI is and what we offer. And also I weave in some warning signs and everything and resources. And yeah, so those are some of the presentations that we offer. And I've even adapted the Ending the Silence presentation at points for before we had the stigma-free workplace presentation. That's a newer presentation. So I adapted Ending Our Silence for all audiences. Like, we went to the Department of Homeland Security here in Philadelphia and did a presentation for them. So we've adapted it to any audience.
I hate to say it, we are out of time. Oh, and yeah. So a parting word, what do you want us to take from this conversation?
I guess I would like people to know that more than anything, they are not alone. The last 2 years have made us all feel so isolated and alone, but NAMI is here. We're an incredible resource for anyone that, like I said, is impacted by mental health. So whether it's, you know, just feeling anxious around the holidays or experiencing a severe mental illness, we are here, and anyone can come to us. You don't need insurance or anything like that.
One quick thought. How do we get through the upcoming holidays?
Self-care, self-care, self-care. I think one of the things that's most important is making a schedule for yourself and being realistic about it. And because I think a lot of the different aspects can be overwhelming, shopping for one, but also having to interact with family members. So if that's, so that schedule can be helpful in terms of, so I'm in recovery from substance abuse and I try to bookend family gatherings with meetings. I go to AA, but you can do that with support groups. And that's the beauty also of everything still being virtual, what we learned in the virtual world. So keeping a schedule to keep things seeming more manageable is really helpful. And taking care of yourself and honoring your feelings.
And of course, for more information about that self-care, they have tips for you. They also have information about all of the programs that are offered, whether it be for schools or for businesses, for youth groups or for any organization. Also the resources from support groups on how to start a conversation. It is all there at namifilly.org. That's namifilly.org. You can also make that donation there too. Follow them on social media, and they have a warm line for questions during business hours, 844-PHL-HOPE. And my guest today, Becca Lane, Education and Outreach Manager for NAMI Philadelphia. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Philadelphia Focus.